Failsafe, guidance for resilient cloud architectures, developed by Microsoft Services and the Azure Customer Advisory Team.
Failsafe is something that Mark and I initiated together with the TWC group, the Azure engineering team. There's a whole bunch of people involved because building reliable services in the cloud is different than building reliable applications or software in an enterprise setting. Because a lot of the reliability sections or initiatives or investments that you can make in an enterprise are focused on hardware. So a lot of quote-unquote sloppy software gets covered or protected by hardware. And lots of people know these kind of very specialized hardwares and so forth. In the cloud, we don't do that. In the cloud, it's all about software. And the hardware is effectively just really providing compute, storage, and network services, and the rest is all software. And that requires us to change things. That's number one. Number two, it's all about scale, and scale at unknown scale. Meaning, in an enterprise, you kind of architect for a known capacity. You kind of have 100,000 users in an enterprise, 50% will be online at any given point in time, that kind of thing. So we all have been there, done that. In a cloud environment, you go from zero users to possibly billions of users if you're very successful, and that requires different thinking. For those that don't know me, my name is Uli Hohmann. I'm the chief architect for the service organization. With me, I have Mark.
I'm Mark Curie. I'm part of the enterprise strategy organization and services.
And these 2 days are going to be fairly tough, meaning we're going to go to level 400 architecture today. So today you won't see any code, we won't show any Azure specifics. We will talk through what are the concepts, the principles, the strategies. And I call it level 400 architecture. And tomorrow Mark Sims from the Azure CAT team is going to come up. And he's going to give you the level 400 drill down into, okay, you have heard Mark and Uli talk about what to do. Let me talk you through how to do these kind of things specific to Azure. So tomorrow is very practical, hands-on day. Today is more, let's talk through the theory and why and all these other things.
So we talk about resiliency. One of the questions we get sometimes is, why should I care? So I'm going to tell you a little bit of a story, a resiliency Christmas story. I want to set the mood. I also like to do gratuitous animations and slides. So this is number one of two that you'll see today. So we get snowing in here. So how many people here are married? Okay. So I'm married too. Woman named Kate, love of my life, mother of my children, and also the daughter of David and Jenny, my in-laws. So she happens to be from the UK, and they decided to visit us for Christmas, which was great. But of course, being from the UK, they're not going to come over for just a couple days. They're going to be here for several weeks. It's now Christmas Eve. My wife comes to me and she said, Mark, you know, I didn't really think that my parents had never been away from England in the 40 years they've been together. This is their first Christmas away. They get some control issues about things they want to have happen. My mom keeps telling me it's not Christmassy enough, but she can't tell me why. Can you please help me? I said, you know what, sweetie, not a worry. I'm going to go to Netflix. I'm going to introduce them to the Frank Capra classic, It's a Wonderful Life. Christmas music movie, if you're not familiar with it. Very popular over here. They hadn't seen it. This is great. It's now quiet. Everybody's happy. We're learning all about George Bailey and his story until Netflix is currently unavailable. So for a little while, it was A Wonderful Life in the McCurry household. But then it suddenly wasn't. And the reality was it wasn't in a lot of households because it didn't come back online until the next day. And whether you looked in, whether you're in France or you're looking at CNN, whether you read The Economist, whether you're watching NBC, CBS, MarketWatch, Business Week, the reality is resiliency is now everybody's problem, right? Your customers are seeing it, whether they're hearing directly at work about something that one of their systems went down, one of the services or SaaS providers they take a dependency on, or consumer sites like Pinterest or Netflix going down. It's now everybody's problem. And I don't point out Netflix or Amazon here because they don't do it well or because we want to poke it at Amazon because they're a competitor. None of us, including Microsoft, have 100% SLA. Right? We need to really change the way that we think about how we write software and take that into consideration. And Netflix, arguably, is one of the best people out there in terms of how they handle resiliency. They're also very forthcoming. I encourage you to read their blog. But they still had challenges. Now, ironically, Amazon, which also runs a streaming video service, did not go down, right? They actually took different measures to build a resilient system, and their video streamed just fine. An ironic measure for me is that we then moved to Amazon streaming, and then my cable provider, who should go nameless, they started having issues. So you have sort of these failovers. We'll talk a little bit more about SLAs of different services that you take advantage of. Now, how many people were in the devices and services training last week or the week before last? Anyone? Okay, so one of the things that we did in that session was there was a demo for Facebook and Facebook integration. It wasn't working, and I was cursing, and I tried it multiple times. Well, guess what? A lot of people ended up getting this error last week. An error occurred. Please try again. So Facebook allows a number of other sites to log in using the login with Facebook button or Facebook Connect. And ironically, some of the same sites that reported the issues at Amazon were now offline themselves because they took a dependency on Facebook Connect or Facebook login. Now, there were lots of responses to this because people couldn't Facebook. It's get my pictures. It's get my friends. You know, ranging from, hey, we've got some outages, to Facebook is too damn powerful, to it's Facebook again, right? Horrible stuff. How could Facebook do this to us? Well, what's the SLA, right? So everyone's taking a dependency on this service. And, you know, I'll give a gift to anyone who can find the SLA for Facebook related to Facebook Connect. It doesn't exist, right? They have some for their other services, which is really nice text that says, if you use us too much, we'll shut you off. But we won't really tell you what too much is, right? But they said about 1 million websites took a dependency on Facebook, and they all went down. So really, shame on the sites hopefully it was an informed decision that they took. A lot of folks don't. I had someone who was going to do a live streaming event that could have hundreds of millions of people on it, and they said, we're going to use Facebook for login. I said, have you talked to Facebook? And he's like, no, do you think we should? Of course you should. You're going to put a tremendous amount of load on this across the globe. You probably want to have a conversation with them. So what we really need to talk about, and what I was sort of alluding to earlier, is that for the longest time, we've talked about mean time to failure. How can I design my system so they don't go down? And I think what we really want to start thinking about is mean time to restore. They're going to go down. No one has 100% SLA. I could do mean time to failure, and it cost me a lot of money. But you know what? You'd be much better if you look at mean time to restore and really go on to... So have you ever seen the movie Glengarry, Glen Ross? Other thing about my presentations, I tend to like movies. There's a scene where they talk about always be closing. I changed that to always be failing. So the reality is that you should look at, and we'll talk about this over the course of the next couple days, you're going to take dependencies on other services, and those services may be offline. The data centers, those services may go offline. One of them may take a dependency on an identity service, such as Facebook Connect, that may go offline. And what you really need to understand is that everything could go wrong. We're going to talk about failure mode analysis and mapping that out so I can understand what is the realm of possibility that could go wrong, and then identify, of those things, what are the things I want to go focus on. And then you want to make sure that you're testing that, right? And testing them in weird combinations. Netflix has a tool they have called Chaos Monkey. I mention it primarily because it's the visual that it evokes, right? So if you always want to be failing and testing things, well, you could build your own scripts. You can test things that you know. But their concept of Chaos Monkey is there's a monkey causing chaos in a back room someplace, just randomly flipping switches, causing all sorts of things that you wouldn't expect. And if you look at a lot of the outages that happened, they are things that they tend not to expect, or it's human error, which they tend not to expect either. So you want to make sure that you do your failure mode analysis up front. We'll talk about that is over the course of this. And then on the back end, once you've built out your system, make sure that you're constantly testing that. We'll talk about some tools that we have, something called the Cloud Overlord. It's an internal sort of shared source project that we're working on. But really want to, over the next couple of days, want to help you really sort of change the mindset and really look at mean time to restore. And if you look at that, and if you look at all the tools that we'll talk about today in terms of architecture and the implementation guidance from Mark Sims tomorrow, you should be doing pretty well, and then we can have ongoing conversations. One thing I will say about the guidance that's here today and tomorrow, it's not ivory tower thinking. So I lead a team of architects. Mark Sims is on a team of architects. Uli is our chief architect for projects that either are incredibly large, and we want to look at those as they get started up to make sure they're designed correctly, or invariably they've gone horribly wrong, right? And they want us to go in and remediate some of these issues. So a lot of what you're going to learn over the next couple of days are theory that's been around for 12 years, distributed computing, but now it's with cloud commoditizing or democratizing, it's much more applicable to a broader audience. And then there's the real pain that we've seen or the real opportunities we've seen in real-world customer engagements.
Just one comment from my side. Most of you will work with enterprise customers, and those enterprise customers are MTTF people, meantime between failure people. They try to avoid failure. Everything should be static, stable, don't touch it. When we talk about mean time to restore and we're talking about Chaos Monkey and those kind of things, it means lots of things are moving all the time, which means it's a psychology error or psychology problem as much as it is a technical issue. And as we all know, humans are really, really don't like change, most of them. And our enterprise customers in the data center don't like change. So your job, if you choose to accept it, is to start changing their mindset. Because once the mindset is changed, they can accept and move forward. But a lot of those guys are still very, very much into, no. My data center is stable. Anything that moves will create a little alert on their single pane of glass thing. And lots of activity happens. And part of what we're trying to do here is effectively make sure that when you convince the customer to move to the cloud, that they are ready for it, and it's okay that things are moving. Things are always failing, but we have strategies in place to avoid catastrophe. That's really what you're trying to do. You're not trying to avoid failure, you're trying to avoid that the system or service goes down. That's what you're trying to avoid. But it's a psychology thing as much as it is a technology thing, so be aware of that when you talk to a CIO or a data center guy, that person will have a different opinion of what that looks like. Because they're not cloud people most of the time, and so that's something to be aware of.
One thing I'll just tack onto that too is that everything you're going to see today is about designing software for the cloud. Right? And obviously you could do it for non-cloud as well. But it's a key distinction, right? So if customers are going to Windows Azure, or to Amazon, or to Salesforce, or to on-premise clouds they're running, everything you're going to learn in day one is applicable. And it's key for a couple of reasons. One is that most customers that we see are saying they're not going to go to one cloud. So being able to have the discussion with them and say it's not about Microsoft cloud, it's about any cloud that you want to build on, you're going to have a better reception. The other reason why we do the distinction is because if you look at other competitors, they're not necessarily telling customers that distributed computing is hard. And we need to make sure that we understand, or we relay the right message, and we're honest with our customers, and we give them all the tools and the education that they need, and then say, and here's the way that we do it on Windows Azure, as opposed to saying coding on Windows Azure is hard, which is not the case. It's distributed computing, here are the patterns you want to use, and here's how you do it on Windows Azure. So just when you're having those discussions, it's a nuance, but I think it's an important one. So what is a modern application?
So this one we will do fairly quick. We're talking about modern applications as a company a lot, so part of what I want to make sure is that we have agreed what the heck it is we're talking about. So you know the trends that are driving all of these things. It's important. Mobility and devices and personalization. That is a key trend, and I have had CTOs, CIOs of very, very large customers come to me and saying, I'm really afraid. I'm afraid of for two reasons. A, I have the ADD generation going on that actually is on 7x24, and they want to be on wherever they are with ideally many, many devices. Let me give you a personal story on that little thing. You remember the Microsoft value proposition of always on, always available, anytime, anywhere? So there was a very large Microsoft event in a nameless hotel in a nameless city. Let's be very, very polite. And 1,000 people descended on this thing. It was a Microsoft event. Lots of business leadership was there. And they expected anytime, anywhere work, meaning approval deals, doing all that stuff. Well, what the hotel didn't realize is that each of these Microsoft guys had at least two devices on it. All of them had Windows 7 or higher on it, and all of them had direct access enabled, which means not only do they have one connection per device, they actually had, in some cases, two connections per device. And they were kind of prepared for 500 VPN connections, but not for an automatic 1,000, because direct access goes immediately into connection mode when you get a Wi-Fi connection. And unfortunately, the provider configured the system in a way that after the 500 first VPN attempt was happening, the system shut down not only the VPN provisioning, but also the IP provisioning. And then there was a rogue DNS server that actually tried to resolve the names but went into nirvana. So the whole hotel was effectively a chaos and no connectivity, none. So you could actually, the only guys, they actually were talking with their executive assistants over the phone to approve deals and do stuff. It was really hilarious to see to some degree. So this mobility and devices thing, we talk a lot about it as being awesome and so forth. It has a lot of impact on the back end. And we're not necessarily bracing for this back end because we still think, I can start my database re-indexer at 3 a.m. in the morning. I do all the operational cleanup tasks and all this other stuff. Yeah, you can, but remember, there is one ADD guy or 10% of your population, which is unknown, remember? We don't know how many people there are that will try and access your service at any given point in time. And that's something we have to design for. Personalization, if you have listened to some of the devices and services talk that Mark and I gave, it's all about making the app smart. Smart for you, smart for your system, which means you are putting a lot of other environments around. It's not just about your app anymore. It's also about, hey, I want this thing to be social. If I have a Yammer environment, let's say for enterprise social, and I say that I'm interested in Office and cloud computing and whatnot, those interests should drive a certain set of behavior of my app. And then take this to the next level where personal means, hey, I actually understand what you did in the past, how you worked with my app and what you were looking for, very much like Bing and other systems do, and I customize my app, which means there's a lot of more processing going on than just doing what the app is required to do, processing this and that and the other. So when you look at these, we rattle this off, yep, this is all goodness. There is a price to be paid on the back end. And then cloud services, again, we all know that that's going to happen. Architecturally, there is no alternative model being proposed at this point in time. We are going to a cloud model, which means a software-defined distributed computing model. Scale out as the design point, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And then big data is just a fact that we are now in a position where we can, economically and technically, and want to collect data. We will talk a lot about telemetry over the next 2 days, because having data to understand what's happening in your app, how your app is behaving, is crucial for a service. Because if there is one thing that is annoying to everybody who is operating something, I'm sure you have a personal experience, if you get this little circle that's spinning for a personal little app, and the app doesn't tell you, is it dead? Is it doing something? What's going on? And imagine you have a service like Facebook that serves 1 billion users, and nobody knows what the app is doing. Is it alive? Is it healthy? Is it performing well? All these things. So telemetry instrumentation effectively lead to big data, which is operational, or eventually leads to personalization. But that also puts strain on your system, because you have to write data, read data, do stuff with it. So when I talk about these, there's a business context, which is exciting, but on the IT side or software development side, you've got to think about this as, oh my God, this is additional set of work that I have to do, and in the case of a consulting organization, write a WBS for. Because none of this work comes for free. You've got to get the customer to understand the value of this stuff and why he has to pay, or he or she has to pay for it, because this is additional work. And it's not trivial work. This is actually really complicated work that needs a lot of experience. The Visual Studio guys put this together. I want to make a couple of points. We talked already about user-centric. We talked a little bit about social-enabled, data-centric. But the bigger point is actually in this circle here, a little continuous improvement one. Norm had a good distinction where he said, we're used to big projects. Big projects that take 24 months or something like that and deliver maybe a 24-month level, which is not true anymore. But the world is moving to programs with lots and lots of deliverables. A 24-month program is acceptable, but only if it has 3-month deliverable times. So you need to think about how you chuck your system apart. Do you highlight the functionality first so that it's sexy, usable, people are interested? Or are you putting the fail-safeness high? What are you going to do first? Because a lot of this is kind of interacting with each other and interdependent. So we have to start designing those things with these principles in mind, meaning user-centric, social, data-centric, and thinking about continuous improvement. And I'm not sure that 3 months is actually going to be acceptable in the long run. I'm sure people want monthly updates to these things, where you have to think through, what is the first set of things I'm going to bring alive? And then how do I continuously improve the experience, the application, the telemetry, and that kind of thing? And how do you sell that? How do you procure it? I have my friend Mike sitting over here, and he works with the public sector in the US. The public sector has no clue how to procure for this, because they are looking at a budget asked, and the budget has to say, well, give me the number right now, what I need to ask for. Well, if you go into a continuous improvement model, how do you know what to ask for? And that's going to be a really, really big pain in the behind until we can figure all of this out, because there is no magic bullet to say, it's going to be this much. No idea. And there are no good answers for this, because we are building, it's really funny, the technology and the business drivers are moving to this agile and more smaller chunks model, whereas the procurement model, public sector on the very heavy side, but even big enterprise customers, if you try to ask for money, they ask you for a business case that tries to go all up and says, this will cost me, let's say, $1 million. And whatever you do, it's going to be wrong. It's going to be very much like capacity planning, where we have no idea what to do. And so we need to figure out how to get customers to understand that this kind of model requires a continuous procurement cycle as well. And let's not just blame the customers. We don't have contracts in the services world that support that kind of continuous delivery. We are doing the same thing. We have an SOW with a defined set of work, WBS, blah, blah. Or we do time and material, which is just warm body shopping. And so there's a lot of these kind of things which are very, very hard, not just on the technical side, but also on the contracting and payment side. Yeah, Mike? You're allowed to ask questions. We want you to be interactive.
So, I am in the public sector, but think about Greenfield for a second. There's at some point where you're building an application, you have a vision of something, you really can't deliver something functional for several months while you're building the building blocks. Yet at the same time, people that VC'd you want to get something for the money. And are you going to go into the trade-offs of delivering something sub-quality just to get out there, in lieu of getting all that functionality in a turnkey monthly cycle?
Yeah. So the observation that Mike is putting forward for the cameras is, well, I'm talking about these things, and we now have some conflicts going on. We have a tension where, on the one side, you want to bring the right building blocks in place, like telemetry and other things. It's like watching grass grow, right? So middleware demos are very, very boring because they don't do anything that the user can understand. At the same time, you need to figure out how you bring functionality to life so that the users that pay for all of this say, I like this, I want to do this. So what's the balance, and are we going to walk through some of these trade-offs and how you do that? And yes, we're going to do that. Whoops. I love that one. Here you go, fail-safe.
That is the demo machine, but we do have a secondary laptop that is easily talked about.
You tell you, fail-safe. It's going to be cool. I tell you. We should have checked.
What's the mean time to restore, guys?
However fast the Optiplex boots. Go ahead. So the observation or the question is, why is it so hard to educate our customers to move from mean time between failure to mean time to restore? Because we never had 100% availability. We always had nines to talk about. The thing is actually not necessarily about the nines. What it's all about is actually the acceptance that everything will fail, not can, will fail. And there's always going to be a part of the system that's not available. And you already see the clue to the solution, because we are actually composing the solution out of many, many parts, and it's acceptable that a part is not available. And if you look into the doctrine of data center operations, data centers are supposed to not move, meaning nothing can be read, that's bad. Well, it might actually be okay, because the service is not that important and somebody wants to have stats, who cares, right? So part of this is understanding that something fails always, and it's not a bad thing per se. When you have a cluster of failure, let's say cluster in the failover sense, and you go into the data center, there's a node done dead in a traditional data center. You know what's happening, right? Lots of excited people running around and trying to get that node replaced and bring it back up so that the cluster is protected again. In a data center, in the cloud, because the technology is moving on, there is no such thing. We are not having failover clusters there. We are having copies of systems, so we have the scale-out model all the way to the back end, so that if a node fails, a partition, it's just one partition, and the system heals itself. It simply brings up another partition and replicates the system so that it becomes self-contained again. So the acceptance is, it will happen. Instead of trying to avoid it and get everybody excited, say, what is the solution to make it repair itself? That's really the differentiation.
I think you hit on this earlier when you were talking about we've solution developers have become complacent when it comes to solutions. We're used to depending on the hardware people.
Yep.
And when you sit and have these failure and resiliency discussions with hardware people, they get it. They've been doing it for 20 years. But when you start talking to software people about it, it's, oh my God, the sky's falling, because they're not used to having to deal with it because the hardware's always been there.
Yep.
So the resistance or the acceptance of this really depends on who you're talking to.
And again, so the observation is that I hit on this before, where actually the hardware guys have been used to this kind of discussion forever. So it's relatively straightforward. And the software developer, I would call the application software developer, has primarily relied on hardware or actually the database to be that system that is always available so that they don't have to think. And that's changing a little bit. It's not changing completely, because we are doing a lot of work to make the app developer more productive and not thinking about this problem too much, but you have to think about it. It's not automagic.
But we've actually been having this discussion with our clients for 2 decades now, in terms of distributed transactions.
Yep.
You can't have distributed transactions.
Oh, I was just about to say, wow.
Yeah, so we've had, business thinks of things in terms of transactional sense, but it's not the reality. And so we've had to have these discussions anyway. This is just a generalization of that.
Yeah, so the observation is that we have had these discussions since quite some time, let's say 2 decades, I'm not sure, but 15 years at least, about distributed transactions, because the business thinks in transactions, although a lot of business people, transactions are different than what we think of as technical transactions. And that has been a discussion ongoing. I think what we are just pointing out, that distributed computing has been around forever, in computer science terms, but now it's becoming to the forefront as the model. There is no real alternative. The alternative model was scale-up, mainframe-like computing, and that's not dying out. There will still be mainframes and mainframe-style computing. Anybody who thinks that a Windows server that was 256 cores and a terabyte of RAM is not a mainframe, you should think again, because that is a mainframe. That's what these things do. There's high I/O systems in those things, very much like a mainframe. But that's not the predominant computing model. And so that's why we are having these discussions now in more clarity and more broader, right?
One thing I would just add to that, Uli, is that we worked with a couple of customers that are now, because the cloud is commoditized, the cloud democratized access, you have 5 people doing things that are fresh out of college, that are doing things before would have, you know, hundreds of thousands of upfront costs that would be a friction point to make sure that you knew what you were doing, because you wouldn't be trusted to touch the hardware and write software on it unless you knew what you were doing. So it's a lot of the folks that we're running into, well-meaning folks, great ideas, but have never had the experience, and the cloud is making it easy for them to get into trouble.
Yep.
But to your point, these patterns are 12 years old, 15 years old in many cases.
And remember the early Visual Basic days when we built client-server applications, and people that had never had to build a complicated distributed app were able to do it? But of course, there were lots of little potholes that they were running into, and they promptly ran into them because we didn't really educate them or provide the tooling and so forth. And that got better, but it is still something that happens. And we're at the same point as I would say Visual Basic 2.0 was. Very good, very functional, but there are lots of other things that need to be added. And the platform will get richer. So a lot of the fail-safe concepts will eventually make it into the platform. Doesn't mean that you should, as a developer, shut off your brain. and not understand what's going on, but the platform will help you and remove some of that investments. So one of the things I am certainly very, very particular about, and Mark has some great examples of sites that can use this kind of thinking, is if you're looking at an environment that is monolithic. Let's say our friends from Exchange had a solution in place which was functionally unbelievably rich and was designed, coming from the ground up, as a monolithic piece of code called mailbox.exe, or store.exe to be precise. It was 40 million lines of code in a single executable. And that's what the reality was. And after Exchange 2003 hit, they really, really started re-architecting the solution, and now Exchange as a backend is very fine-grained, decomposed, and you have lots of options to deploy it and secure it and stuff like that. Because they realized that if you have a single executable, you can't really do much. It's very much you got to secure that thing, and this is the app. It's up or down. That's it. You can't do much. And we see this now for a number of reasons. It's not just because of fail-safe, but also because people want to purchase differently. We see people now partitioning or decomposing their application environments and are talking about, instead of talking CRM, they're talking Salesforce automation, marketing automation, and so forth. The partitions here are not important. The only idea is that you go from these big pieces to smaller pieces. And you start thinking about, when I look at a project or an app, what would that look like instead of looking at this? Instead of saying a single thing that actually has to be available all up or not. You're trying to figure out how you get to options. To say this part of the app needs to be available very much. This part of the app, if that's not available, that's okay. If a person might not be able to get his BI report at 9 a.m. in the morning because the BI services are down, maybe that's not so bad. It might be bad, but it might not be. And we will walk you through how you model these kind of things and what are the considerations you should take into account when you decompose your system. The Japanese bullet train, everybody kind of have heard about those, right? Where they shove people in. It's very interesting. But the interesting thing is the bullet train system is 100% up all the time. The word is system. There's a lot of stuff underneath or behind the scenes that's down. People can't get into a certain subway station because the door management system is down. But these guys have used decomposition on the system side, and they use also geography and physical stuff to partition the system, so the system is always up. Parts of it are continuously renovated and revamped. SQL Azure. When we put SQL Azure out in first, we had, I think, about 1,000 nodes running in a cluster. And the system was continuously being maintained. Operating system updates, SQL Azure updates, all sorts of things. And we had a service up and running on this, our email archiving service. So SQL Azure said, we're always available, although the official SLA is 99 point something. But they were really always available. But on maintenance went on all the time, but the dependent service, like the email archiving boys and girls, could always rely. How? They were actually taking machines on and off and were using the clustering capabilities, load balancing, to move workloads around, keeping the system up, but parts of it were always maintained. In order to do that, you have to understand how you partition the thing. And that's really what this slide is all about. The other thing we won't talk much about, but we clearly wanted to mention it, there is a lot of fail-safe techniques that people have used actually already. So, for example, the New York Police Department is running on Windows Azure. They have a very interesting app on that environment. Their fail-safe policy was fall back to on-premise, which is perfectly fine, and that's how they implemented it because they can't fail. But Azure allowed them to be more flexible, scalable, cheaper, and they already had an on-premise environment, so that was okay. So don't think just fail-safe, it's all cloud. As Mark said, it's cloud in the architecture sense, not in the deployment or business model sense. It could be private cloud, hybrid cloud, service provider, clouds, et cetera, et cetera. You just need to think about how you connect. And of course, we will talk about failure modes. Each of these can be a failure mode. Who in this crowd is more of an infrastructure person? Over there. So one plea I have for you guys. Infrastructure people love this stuff, meaning secure machine-to-machine connectivity, site-to-network connectivity, and stuff like that. That's cool. It's really nice, and it's important we have that capability. But this is a last resort, because those are the most expensive and, to a degree, fragile integrations that you can have, because they're linking physical environments together. These two guys here, data center, data synchronization and application integration, are much more flexible and cheaper. So if you can get away with not connecting the sites or the network or the machines, that's a good thing. Again, there's lots of reasons why you want to do that, but if you can get away with this side here, the middle tier, the application-oriented integration, much cheaper. And that goes between clouds as well, cloud-to-cloud integration. Again, you could link Amazon AWS to a Azure IIS system using similar techniques like the machine-to-machine connectivity and so forth. That is not necessarily the best way of doing it from a scalability and availability perspective. So, what are we going to talk about? These are the six big building blocks with lots of detail behind them. We will talk about how you move from a software environment into a services environment. And lots of people say, well, isn't that the same? Not quite. A lot of our product groups have done a lot of learning in that journey to the cloud. And they learned that you have to balance functionality to operational considerations. And it's not a one-size-fits-all. You have to really think it through. And that's something we will walk you through. We'll talk about services, not servers. That's a very important piece. I don't think that's that hard anymore. I think everybody accepts that it's all about scale-out. And that means you have copies running around and not singletons. So if you still like in your software design singletons, we need to work on that, because singletons tend to be very, very naughty, because you can't copy them, they are stateful and all these other things. Not something to think about. We'll spend quite a lot of time on decomposition by workload, because as I said before, it is the trick of how you manage to build systems that are reliable, while the service might actually have parts that are off or degraded or being maintained and stuff like that. We'll talk a lot about lifecycle. Mark has some great examples of what that looks like. We will talk about scale unit design. This is really when you have null capacity, meaning unknown, for the database guys that are still in the null world. You have unknown capacity. How do you deal with that? How do you design a system? And the trick that the cloud people use, starting by our Hotmail friends, when you introduce webmail in a world that does barely understand corporate email, how do you make sure that you don't over-provision? How do you make sure that you don't under-provision? Because the demand might be very, very high, or it might be nothing. And so the scale unit is effectively that kind of idea. And also remember, while we have an elastic environment in Windows Azure, provisioning does take time. There are physics involved. You need to get VMs up and running. You need to do all this configuration stuff, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So thinking through how you compose the unit of scale you want to provision is an important step. And then we will spend a lot of time on design for operations, because silent or services run in a black hole, and you need to make them talk. That's really what you need to shine a light into those. And effectively, a lot of this depends on how you think about the operating of the system. Isn't it a cute graphic? And PowerPoint, for some reason, has managed to put some of these guys a little bit out of whack. Just a little walk through the platform changes we are seeing, and what is, for example, fabric computing. A lot of people use the word very, very carefully, like casually. Yeah, we understand what fabric computing is. I would love to do a quiz, but we won't do that. What the heck is fabric computing? So this is a slide set I copied from Dave Campbell, who was at TechReady on Friday, who did the Tech Fellow speak about big data. and he talked a lot about these kind of things. And he describes it fairly well in terms of how are we really changing the system? How does it work? So the first thing is, if you look at today's world, that's what we do. We purchase, we install the operating system, we install the role on the operating system, we deploy the app, we configure the app. And each of this is early bound. You need to look at the entire thing and so forth. It's difficult to balance isolation and utilization. And what's more important, the way we patch these systems makes each of these instances unique. Because despite all of our efforts, and the industry clearly has done a lot of effort, the systems, once you start patching, once you install software packages, become unique. Because the systems that do the patching are smart. They make decisions. They actually say, I found this, this, and that, so I make go this path. If they found something else, they go this way. In laptops and desktops, that's normal because humans do stuff to it in addition to the system doing stuff to it. On the server side, you think that that wouldn't be the case, but because of the way the system works, there is derivation. Technically speaking, you won't find a lot of it, but it is entirely feasible because it's a non-deterministic system. So not only is it this kind of thing, it's actually each of these instances that you create and maintain over time are unique. Very, very bad situation if you think about, I want to run a service that is has copies of the same stuff. Just to give you some hint of how Azure solves this, no setup.exe on Azure. It doesn't work. You can't do it. So if you bring a software package up there, it is a software package that gets redeployed pretty much every time. And that's how you avoid that little problem. Our virtualization friends have come in and effectively decoupled the hardware-software boundary, because a lot of times when you wanted to move the hardware underneath the covers or you moved the software, because it was such a tight coupled system, you had to do a lot of dramatic things. And a lot of our application people, especially when they are very much focused on their hardware and their requirements, don't understand the benefits of being able to replace the hardware independent of the software stack. And vice versa. And without having to have a tight binding and coupling. So the software stack is unfortunately still very statically bound. It's still the same model, although the hardware is now more flexible. When you look at now the fabric guys, they really are trying to figure out a way to tell you, no. Don't think about servers. Think about capacity you required and capabilities. And we are now supporting you across a set of resources, and now we are managing that as one resource. So the fabric controller that Windows Azure talks about is that one resource manager that understands a certain chunk of resource. I think it's about 1,000 servers, right?
Yeah.
It's 1,000 servers, and those physical servers get automatically managed all up. And the system understands a concept called a service. And that service is the unit of deployment, management, security, and so forth. Literally, Windows Azure takes a service-oriented infrastructure approach and uses service configurations, so these XML files that you might have already authored yourself, to deploy the machines, understand where your software needs to go, what software they can move around, VLANs, all these other things that we used to do manually is all done against the fabric. So they don't look at servers and partitions. They look at the fabric and use the service concept to isolate and migrate and move things around. Are they where we want them to be as a software development environment? Not really, because they still think about virtual machines. They call them web roles and worker roles and so forth, but it's still a virtual machine at the end of the day. Again, there will be new and higher level things. But the fabric idea is very important, where you look at this and you're looking at the provisioned, the aggregate provisioning concept rather than it's my machine, it's my concept, etc. I used some of these terms already. I just want to make sure that we're all speaking the same language. Our friends in Azure actually have a couple of components that you need to be aware of. And if I advise a customer about a private cloud environment, and they really want to write their own software, I am talking to them about mimicking some of these concepts. and also thinking through how they could use networks and boundaries to make sure that the software is isolatable and so forth. So first is the word of a service. I mentioned it already, it's a network boundary primarily. And we're using the machines within that boundary as a resource pool for that specific service. And then we have the web role, which is IIS enabled. The worker role is by default not IIS enabled, but you can. And it's really just a VM at the end of the day. And you have these types, and then you have instances of the types. Those are important because Azure effectively will stamp out new instances of a role based on a template. And most of you guys know that Azure has a very creative failure model. We will talk about this later, which is called fail fast. And we don't, Azure assumes that the state of your VM is irrelevant. And people are like, what does that mean? What that means is if you have data that's in that VM that you use to service your customer or your application, Azure will not recover it. It will effectively destroy the VM if it gets into trouble, or if Azure needs the room for another VM, you will be gone. Right? That's the promise that they make to you, but they do it very publicly. There's benefits to it for you because you know what to expect, but it's also complicated because we live in the world of live migration and all these other crazy things that the infrastructure has to do because the apps are poorly written. The assumption that Azure makes is that your state, the data you care about, is persisted somewhere else. So Azure has two classes of systems. One is a VM class, which is what's called stateless. And then they have storage environments, which are permanent or persistent, where they have a different error handling model than they have on the VMs. Much more involved, much more detailed. So for example, SQL Azure uses multiple copies. And they have automatic technologies underneath it that brings, if a node fails or if a partition fails, as I said before, they will recreate the 3-node cluster, logical cluster, and populate the systems and so forth. That's all automagic. No failover clustering with fixed clusters and quorum disks and stuff like that. A lot of the concepts are the same, but they are now implemented in software, and the software balances it. So the fabric controller understands, oh, this is a permanent machine, and this is a VM that I can play with. Much more flexible. The permanent ones are much harder. The best way I visualize these things, all of you run disk defrag once in a while, right, on your Windows machines. Think about disk defrag as the Azure fabric controller and the little blocks as hosts. And when you put a permanent machine in there, like a SQL Azure, is becoming much harder to move that block. It's almost an unmovable block. And what you're trying to do is avoid creating so many unmovable blocks that the system is effectively not able to move anymore. And so the VM, the stateless VM, is effectively a movable block that you can move around and optimize and compress and stuff like that. So that's the design of a service. And then, of course, you can take service dependencies. Important. Mark will talk a lot about what that means when you take a service dependence, because this combination all of a sudden becomes your app. And one of the key things that you got to get into your head, really, really don't lose it. A server is not a service, and a service is not a server. So I mentioned it as a architecture and deployment unit, but from a dependencies perspective, we have seen truckloads of developers, including very, very good professional ISV developers that write code day in, day out, assuming that SQL Azure as a service is the same as SQL Server. You can argue, what does the same mean? Well, the same means on the one side it has the same capability, transactional SQL and all sorts of other features and functions. That one we will get there. SQL Azure isn't quite there yet, but it's very close to be feature compatible to SQL Azure. There are a certain set of things that are not feasible due to the security and isolation model of Azure in itself, but conceptually you will be able to write a piece of code, functional code, that is the same between SQL Server and SQL Azure. You can do that today with when you know what the differences are, but that's We're going to get there. I'm not worried. What we'll never get is that SQL Server and SQL Azure will have the same latency. Because SQL Server in this world would be a role. And you can do that with infrastructure as a service. You can put SQL Server into this service, which guarantees that Azure will put it behind the same network load balancer. If it's you using SQL Azure, it's guaranteed that this SQL Azure instance is behind a different network load balancer. So your service, this one here, or this one, runs in network load balancer A, and SQL Azure will run behind network load balancer B. Guaranteed. And you have to understand that it's at least three times the latency between a role calling each other and a service calling each other. And that's really, really critical because a lot of people use SQL Server as a cache. Because it's so fast, it's an enterprise architecture, you have the server right next to each other, cluster design, you use very fast networks and all these other things to make the SQL Server respond. They call the thing 10,000 times a second. We have seen people do that, especially once you use object relational access method, that's very easy to do. Nothing against object relational calling, that's not the statement I'm making, you just have to understand latency is a fact. Speed of light, physics, all these kind of things are important. And so you need to, this is a critical slide, that's why I'm hammering on it, because of this little thing. And when you look at service-oriented computing or cloud computing, it's all network computing, and networks equal latency. You've got to deal with it, and of course it's a failure point as well. Something might not be able to available. So if you have a goal to be 100% available, you have to live with the fact that this thing might not be there, or other services like the Facebook example that Mark brought, they're not there. What are you going to do? What's plan B? Kind of thing. Sorry. Well,
they will now be on video.
Well, they are going to be on video, and we have written a first version of the fail-safe white paper on MSDN. Well, I'm not sure we're talking a lot about this stuff, but we do mention the service dependency discussions and so forth. So I will reread the paper and see if the network latency discussion is serious enough. Because a lot of our people think that networks just work. Well, the great example of this unnamed hotel in an unnamed city is great. Before that, actually, on the trip to that unnamed city and unnamed hotel, my friends from an unnamed airline in Seattle had an outage as well. Literally, a farmer buried a cow. Seriously, it was not a joke. The farmer buried a cow and cut through Sprint's network cable. And for some reason, the Sprint network cable and the unnamed airline computer systems were running over that cable, and they didn't have a backup. No idea why. They didn't do a fail-safe design. And so I was sitting in the airport at 6:30 a.m. to get to this unnamed city, and I think I was still sitting there at 2 p.m., which I'm sure you guys have done and experienced as well. And then they found a terminal, a single terminal in Las Vegas that was online. And so they actually were using a cell phone mechanism to check you off the manifest. They looked at your boarding pass, then they called you in, Roman 6B. Yep, accepted. And then you were aligned, and there were a couple of people that weren't on the manifest that the computer saw, although they had a boarding pass. Sorry, can't board. It took forever. So again, another example where the network is just so critical. And you need to understand what your dependencies are. And Azure does it really well, where they're actually using service-oriented design all up. We just need to accept that a server is not a service. It really isn't, and it's very important. Go ahead.
Actually, can I answer one last piece for Aaron's question just about the location?
Yeah.
So I said facetiously it's going to be on video, but for folks that are watching at home, or if you've run across this through other means, if you go to the Windows Azure Architecture Center, documents are there, both from services and CAT team. It's going to continue to grow, as will be MSDN, and these videos and others will be placed on site of Channel 9, so channel9.msdn.com, so people can see the videos in one place, and we'll continue to grow this over time.
Yep.
So, you provision maybe a couple of VMs with some small-scale applications,
is that if your VMs crash, you lose your data.
So the observation is that the Windows Azure model that I described is, I have an app, I create a bunch of VMs and I run my app, I'm using my database and all is good until Azure decides I need that VM so I will recycle it. You lose your data. The answer is yes, because as documented on Windows Azure site and part of the patterns that we describe, you are supposed to take your state and continuously save it in a place that's safe, like SQL Azure or a blob or a distributed cache or on-premise, whatever. You don't want to do that, by the way, but when I talk state, I'm meaning, for example, session state. So you're getting a website and you want to store the interactions and you want to build the shopping basket, let's say. You don't want to put that shopping basket just into the VM. You want to put it into a cache or into a database so that if the system gets recycled, again, which is part of the pattern of Windows Azure, then you can reconstitute the shopping basket in another VM. And it's not a new pattern. We have done this a lot of times. The first time when Pat Helland in 1996 stood up on stage and said, Microsoft Transaction Server is a stateless system, he got killed on stage. People really, really, really hated that idea. Now, guess what? It's mainstream. That's what we do now. And Windows Azure is one implementation. Other people do it similarly. The way I describe this is actually not stateless. It's actually managed state. It's managed state. You really want to think through where you put the state, what state is important, and what do you want to recover. It's recoverability rather than statelessness that you're looking for. It's perfectly okay to have state. You just have to say, where do I put that state, and how do I make sure it's available after or when or if the machine has a problem. That's really what it is.
Thank you, sir.
Monsieur Mercury.
French accent, Italian name. I'm not sure if I'm a German guy. I don't know how that works, but
we will get there.
We'll get there. So, some of the more interesting conversations, and for folks at home, I'm saying interesting with air quotes, that I have tend to be around the nines. Right. So, when we talk about cloud services, people say, "Oh, I need to have five nines, four nines, three nines," whatever they happen to read that morning, or their buddy at on the train told them on the way in that morning. But they don't necessarily know what that means. So I go in and have a conversation with them. So how much downtime does that mean for you? And like, what do you mean? I just need four nines. So they really don't necessarily understand what's behind it. So, and we're going to talk about nines today because this is one of the areas that we tend to see people have some challenges with. We actually have an Excel template that will take you through some of the things we're going to talk about in this first section this morning to make it really easy to have conversations with your customers. You can see here, based on the 1 9, 2 9, 3 9s, 5 9s, 6 9s, what that translates to. And you can see what we have here for Windows Azure. But let's go ahead and look at this in the context of an app.
And just, Mark, just for fun, a lot of people actually really don't know what that means. When go back to this one, downtime per week, downtime per month, per year, most people really don't know. 31.5 seconds downtime for a 6.9 system. You can't do anything. That thing has to be up and running. And so a lot of people ask for 5.9s because that's what they heard.
And
they have no idea what it means in terms of cost, running that kind of thing, doing these kind of things.
What would be very interesting to allied with that conversation is, what is the difference in operating costs hardware costs? Just for representative apps, you're just building a site with single web server, single database, and you want to have 6 9s versus 2 9s. This is going to cost you $2,000 a month. This is going to cost you $25,000 a month to run.
Yep.
So we get to the end of the day, we're going to... So the question or the observation was is that I have a single front end with a single SQL database in the back end, four nines versus 5 9s. You know, there are distinct differences in the cost, as Uli was talking about. The downtime for one is relatively minor. And for most people, for most systems, they don't necessarily need 5 9s. So really understanding what the cost differentials are between 4 and 5 are really helpful. So at the end of the day, going back to that spreadsheet I mentioned earlier, that is exactly what we want to do. So when I have a conversation with customers, I don't even start with nines. We'll do lifecycle modeling. We'll talk about what that is. But it's really, is it the highest, high, medium, lower, lowest over the course of a given lifecycle? We'll talk about it a bit later. And then we eventually get to the nines. Because once you apply a cost, as you're alluding to, it suddenly becomes a lot less important if it's an extra $1 million to get me a couple more minutes. The other interesting thing, I'm glad Uli had me go back to this one, is because Windows Azure has SLAs. And I've had a disturbing number of conversations when I've asked people about the SLAs for their apps, because invariably we're trying to fix them. or trying to get them a design that's going to get them where they want. And they said, oh, well, SLA is sorted. It's going to be 99.95. It's going to be 99.9. Like, where did you get that? Oh, well, it's Windows Azure, right? The services I'm using, that's what that is. I'm like, well, that's a service. It's one of many services that you're using. In this case, you could look at an app that's put together with five different services. And this is another thing we tend to see a lot. Well, look, there are these four services, and they've got four nines. So the SLA for my service has to be four nines as well, right? No. But everyone here, you're here on a Monday morning learning about resiliency, so you know this isn't true. The reality is the composite is 99.95 as a starting point. You can write code that's bad, that's going to take this way down. You can write, do an implementation that's quite good. Maybe you're failing over to on-premise and actually bring this up. We have some customers that say, you know what? Love what Windows Azure can provide for me, but I want a little bit better for this workload. You know, we talk about decomposing by workload. So for this thing, yeah, you know what? For that piece, for that workload, we can have something that can fail over to on-premise and get it a bit higher, but really understand the implications. But let's make it real, right? And giving credit where credit is due, this is from Mark Sims' presentation last Friday, where you can say, this is my SLA. My goal is 99.99. Well, I've got Azure Storage that's 99.9. I've got Azure Compute, which is 99.95. Get Azure SQL Database, 99.9, and then SendGrid. SendGrid doesn't have an SLA. Right? There's no posted SLA for that. So SendGrid, for those less familiar, it's a way for you to send email in mass. Right? They've done a really good job of doing this. They're an industry go-to person, go-to service provider. They also handle things like if you want to send things in mass, you're not flagged as a spammer. Right? So there really isn't anyone else who can do that at scale. There could be a couple folks, but this is the go-to folks, but they don't have an SLA. So my composite SLA is clearly not 99.9. It's question mark. You know, what is it going to be? Now, does that mean I don't use SendGrid? Well, for the price, that probably is something that makes sense for me. But I can build a system that sort of, if anyone's here a golfer, right, you can play into the slice. So I know that this is a problem for me. So that's fine. What I'm going to do is say I'm going to collect any information that I want to send in an email. My user response on the screen will be, you'll get an email response from us shortly. And then maybe I'll throw it on a queue. And then when that's available again, I'll send it out. Maybe I'll have a failover email provider to handle a certain level of volume that can pick things up in the interim, and then we'll eventually fall back that's there. But really, you know, Facebook, great example there. We mentioned earlier, identity system for a million sites on the web went offline. And they were sort of contrite about their reason for why it happened. I'll let you read it. But at the end of the day, you're taking a dependency on a service. In this case, it's a paid service. In Facebook's case, it's a non-paid service, although you technically pay for it. You don't pay for it with money, but you pay for it with your user data. And you just have to figure that in and say, is that a risk that I'm worth, it's a risk worth taking? And when you do your failure mode analysis, you'll weigh that in and make a decision. With Facebook, you can say, you know what, I'll let people do a certain amount of things without having to log in. So you can get to certain aspects of my site. I can look at popular feeds and that sort of thing if I can't get onto their identity page. So yeah, just going back to, this is something that most people don't do. And I'll give you another example. So this is on the SendGrid page. If you search for SLA, no results are found. Right? They don't have one. I'll give you an example of a site that was designed to scale and designed to fail. We had built a site. Well, we had built some software for a social community site. We had interest from a very large public sector organization. They said, hey, this is great. What we want to do is we want to engage with our citizenry. We're going to announce this on every major news network in the country. That's a pretty big country. And I said, okay, but legally I can't help you with that because that would be considered a gift because I wasn't in consulting at that time. I'm a non-billable resource. That's a gift. That's a felony. I would go to jail, and I love seeing my children and my wife. We talked about that in the beginning. So he said, all right, so what we can do is we can make it available as open source, and you can get a partner to take you the last mile. That's great. I said, but what I can do is, you know, we know how to test these things. We know how to secure these things. We'll have our A security team take a look at it. There's a team inside Microsoft that tests our site. And we'll go ahead and make sure that we do testing to 8 million requests. 8 million requests an hour, which should be more than for what you need based on where you're going. They said, that's great. Give it to the partner. They make it look pretty. They do all the skin. Great design shop. It goes live, and it starts to fail. My phone starts ringing about 5 minutes later. And then it's very interesting. If you've ever seen I can't say the name of the country, but if you've ever seen sort of the succession plan as it goes up the stack, I start getting calls higher and higher up the stack to the person who's third in line from running the country. And they're like, what's going on? You need to take a look at this. So we look into it, and I said, all right, well, we just need to do the right thing. And we look at what's happened, and they've had a junior developer who insists he's made no code changes, because that always happens, right? Worked fine on my machine. And he said, oh, yeah. You know, they wanted to do short URLs. I think I just throw something in there, this thing called Bitly. And I just put a couple calls in there, worked great on my machine, pushed it up there. We did a little bit of testing. It was fine. Of course, they didn't do any stress testing or load testing, anything like that. And as it turns out, if you do a casual search on Bitly, it will say, if you call this from more than 4 servers, we will throttle you. And throttling is something we'll talk about in a bit. Well, guess what? They launched it on 32 servers on national television. And oh, by the way, there's a little hacker group who will say, I won't say their name, they're anonymous. But they decided to go and attack the site at the same time. So it was not a fun day for me. I was in a room in a hotel in some country for 48 hours. So throttling. So great, you've determined which SLAs, which services you're going to take a dependency on, and they have their own SLAs. But guess what? They can still deny you service and still meet their SLAs. They can be online, but they're going to have certain constraints on that service because they have a number. You're not the only customer. There are going to be a number of customers, and they need to keep the service API healthy for everyone. And then, if you've ever read Orwell, I'll paraphrase, you know, all customers are equal. Some are more equal than others. If you spend a lot more money with me, if I need to turn people off, I'm probably going to throttle you and turn you off last. And the folks that are doing $5, $10 transactions, the hobbyists are going to get shut off first.
Mark, so this is from your perspective. While we are now talking about dependencies and how you manage dependencies, this is a great technique that you should learn about, how you manage your own service, because you will get attacked, you will get crazy people, and again, Mark will talk about different types of crazy people and how you want to deal with those, but throttling is a key principle and pattern that you need to put into your own service. Understand what that means and really put it in there.
We'll talk about it later. I have a slide on bad actors. I had a picture of William Shatner in there, and the legal guys made me take it out, but we'll talk about that a little bit later on. But they can go ahead and throttle you, right? And you really want to have them understand what are the constraints that are there. So if you look at a storage account in Windows Azure, I can do 5,000 requests a minute. Okay? That's not enough for me. Well, guess what? But I can have as many service accounts as I want. Well, guess what? They'll just keep adding service accounts, and I'll build it into my architecture. Going back to the sort of the golf analogy, I'll play into the slice. There's a certain level of constraints. I need like 10 times that. Well, guess what? I'll get 10 accounts. And then I can scale horizontally. Right. So going up and do that horizontal scale makes a lot of sense. So really just building that into your infrastructure. So the other thing is when you define your SLA, you're going to come up with your nines. But the reality is that your nines reflect the different aspects of your application. So this is a real-world application. This particular customer is doing a sports API. And the sports API really has two, and they're delivering data services that go out to mobile devices and all sorts of fun apps. And they have live scores, and they have team player and league stats. So the SLA for the service is 99.9% all the time, but if you go into the workloads that are there, well, live scores, that really only comes into play when there's a game going on. So that's 100% when there's a game, 0% when there's no game, and the player stats, it's 90% all the time. If I don't get the historical stats for David Beckham on his new team, well, I'm really not that bothered if it happens to be on a Monday or a Tuesday. If I want to see what's happening in the game, his first game out in the pitch, I want to know exactly what's going on right away. Has he gotten red carded like he did in that game with Argentina back in the World Cup for soccer fans out there? We'll take a look at that, but we really want to make sure that we've got different availabilities, and then we'll model out the life cycle. We'll talk about that in a little bit. But what you can see here is that I've now decomposed by workload, and the stats actually have a different usage model, and the live scores have a different usage model. So we talk about the elasticity of the cloud. We talk about decomposing by workloads. Well, now I've broken apart my app into two distinct workloads that have different usage patterns and different times of the week. Elasticity, I can take advantage of it. And we get a little bit further into decomposing by workload. You're going to get technology choices you can make that are bit different. You can do caching strategies that are a bit different. You can do resiliency plans that are a bit different. And it's going to give you a lot of value. So decomposing by workload. So your application is composed of one or more workloads. We just saw two, right? A live stats API. We've got the in-game API. We're working with the team in China. They have a connected car application. There's going to be an API. You could think of traffic as one API. You could think of GPS as another, as a workload. You can look at traffic as another workload. Content services is different types of workloads that are there. But the reality is your application is going to have a number of different pieces to it. If you look at an e-commerce site, there could be, as we will in the next slide, you could have the search and browse functionality. There's handling payment. There's management and operations. There are a number of different things that are there, and then I can make certain decisions based on the workload. So if you think about Facebook, Facebook isn't a monolithic app, right? If I think about the displaying of my profile on Facebook, if that was a relational database table, that'd be about 23, 24 joins. Well, guess what? There are NoSQL solutions that would be a great answer for that, and that's indeed what Facebook does. There may be other places where table storage makes sense for me to use. But I can now, before where we may have said SQL Server or a relational database is my answer for the solution, it is now the solution for the workload. And it may be the solution in a workload in a particular context. So what I mean by that is that we'll talk about the three Vs later on and what those mean, but I think about a usage pattern. I want to go ahead and do a shopping basket or do shopping basket analysis. So I'm going to need to do certain things with data in real time. And I may use table storage for that. I may want to do shopping basket analysis later on and do some analytics and maybe do some relational queries, maybe once a week or once a month, perhaps. Well, I could take information that I had put into table storage and put that into a relational store and do aggregations on it on a periodic basis. So I get the best of both worlds. For the real time, for the workload that is handling the shopping experience, the shop and browse experience, we're going to use table storage. And for the workload that's going to handle reporting, we're going to use relational storage. And that will be fed from the table store for that particular piece of data. You're also going to be able to do availability planning for that. So for that particular workload, as we talked about with the sports API, it has to be up 100%. But the other one, well, it doesn't have to be 100%. That's probably okay. We've talked to people that are doing live streaming events. And for if you want to see a musical artist and you're paying to see this person live on the web, you know, whether it's Lady Gaga or someone else like that, well, I paid to see that person. That has to be up 100%. Fail over to a data center if you have to. If I miss 20 seconds of that and it's a song that I love, that's going to ruin the experience for me. I'm going to want my money back. If I can't tweet this out to my friends, I'll probably live, right? So really having those sorts of discussions with yourselves and your customers around that, and also from health models. We'll talk about designing for operations later on. You want to design your, these are distributed systems, and the services you're building potentially could be consumed by other people. You know, we're seeing people building services for themselves they're now selling on to others, or data services they use internally that they're selling on to others. You want these things to be self-healing. You want them to be able to, if there's a problem, fix themselves so you don't get a pager call, if people still have pagers. You don't get a phone call in the middle of the night. And we'll talk about that a little bit later on, but you're going to be able to do all of this at a workload level. So it's going to increase the amount of flexibility you have. You can look at cost, all these things at the individual workloads. So we talked about an e-commerce site, so searching and browsing, checkout. So checkout, we talk about resiliency. Think about this. I'm using a payment provider. That payment provider goes offline. I'm Amazon. I'm, you know, Mark McCurry e-commerce store or whatever. I want to be able to make sure I capture the order. I may not be able to capture your payment. And Amazon.com, the e-commerce side of their business, does this today. You'll place an order. I'll say, thank you for an order. You'll get a confirmation email shortly. Or they'll say, and look at the nuances. You'll see different messages based on the time. It's like, we've accepted your order. We'll send you the confirmation shortly. Or we've got your order. We'll get back to you soon. In some cases, the payment provider is online. In some cases, it's not, but they're recording the information. So from your perspective, the experience is great. You've got my information. I assume that you're going to fill it for me. And 9 times out of 10 or 99 out of 100 times, they're going to be able to do that for people. And they've captured your information. Because if I can't do that, if I can't check out, well, then I'm probably going to go someplace else.
So one of the things that when I look at designs, we always design for the edge case. We always design for the failure and trying to figure out how we fix the failure. One of the things that we have learned with cloud computing, especially, people are actually far more generous than you give them credit for. Sometimes, again, the example I always use is checking out nuclear warheads. You do want to be guaranteed that that happened and nobody else and all these other good things. But if it's about buying a book, you know what? If the system says, comes back to you, sorry, I didn't do this right, can you please type it again? Most people actually say, yeah, okay, fine. If you look at certain ERP systems, I won't name names, they actually have batch processing systems where the batch process is designed to fail. And that's okay. If the system fails, then it gets run again. If it happens with a real-time transaction where the user sits there, they actually do send a mail back saying, sorry, didn't go through, can you do that again? And we have to live with that kind of approach in mind. It doesn't mean that we always ask the user to do it again, but being able to replay activities and other things. So don't try and by crazy means prevent things from not happening if it's really the edge case. If it's the normal case, you might want to think about it. But if it happens once out of 100,000 transactions, don't try and fix that one problem case because it's going to not happen that often. So statistically, play around with these workloads and the failures in the workloads and deal with them.
Mm-hmm. I mean, often if you get a failure 1 in 100,000 times, you could just say, I'm sorry, we're going to deliver it 2 days late,
yep.
You'll have it for free.
Yeah.
know, so the business model may come in entirely, and if you weigh that up against the cost of more resilient system, it's probably easy.
The observation that is being shared is effectively, you can also use business models or business incentives to cover your as your error recovery mechanism, saying, hey, if I failed it at the first time, but I can fix it in 2 days' time, I might give the person free shipping or other incentives to do stuff. And a lot of us in the technology sector are trying to say, no, we can fix it. But it's so expensive sometimes to fix or prevent the failure that it's much, much cheaper for the business to just, hey, send a coupon. You get $5 free the next time. And it's really amazing. How many of you love swag? It's the cheapest thing that you can do to get loyalty. It's really funny, but Microsoft people wearing that are possibly millionaires, but they wear the Microsoft shirt because it's free. We love free stuff as human beings. And Mark will talk about social later. The tricks the social guys and girls are playing is effectively the trick with human beings. We love free stuff. So there's a lot of ways you can incent when your app doesn't do the thing that it's supposed to be doing. There is business ways to solve it, not just technology ways.
So lifecycle modeling, and this is really important. This is going to help you get to the nines and help you really build out your application. So think about how your application is, or how your services are going to be used, right? And really we're looking at this now at the workload level. We've got some folks here that are tied to a project we're doing in China on this connected car company. If I've got a car, well, there are certain times of the year that people drive more. That's over the course, you know, different months, right? Summer months, people tend to drive more on vacation. Over the course of the week, people tend to drive a lot more during different days. And then intraday, if you think about an average work day, a few hours in the morning, people are driving to work. A few hours in the evening, people are driving home. Of course, people are driving all the time. But there are certain key hours that you're going to really annoy a lot of your customers. So defining that life cycle is going to help you really understand, you know, what level of capacity, what level of availability do I have. If I'm doing a music event, if I've got the opening act versus you know, Lady Gaga or someone else, if a celebrity is going to be on stage versus an opening act, your up-level time is going to have to be at different points there. There are also one-off events. So if you're doing something and going back to this event company, you're going to go ahead and launch this event, but you're going to have a number of things, PR events, websites, things that are going up, sporting events, same sort of thing. And really understanding the life cycle. If you were doing, say, the Olympics, for example, Michael Phelps was an American swimmer. He said he was going to retire last time. For his race, I imagine that's something you want to have super high availability for, right? And you want to make sure that there's a significant amount of uptime because a lot of eyes are going to watch that in real time, and they don't want to see the tweets from their friends saying, did you just see that? But really understanding the life cycle is good from the availability perspective, and also from a costing perspective. You can start taking advantage of elasticity. You can start turning things off. We'll talk about scale units and the ability to scale up and scale down. You know, we talk about it a lot, but not as many people do it.
So one of the caution things I want to put into your notes is a lot of times you know a little bit about this behavior, but you don't know as much as you think. And so telemetry comes in really handy here, saying make some base assumptions, but be able to deal with, oh, my assumptions were wrong, so that you correct it over time. So for example, I'm sure MSIT could give us those numbers. In the morning between, let's say, 8 and 9:30, AD is very, very busy authenticating users and that kind of thing. And then it really goes down. You could actually almost turn AD off until the next morning, almost, I said. And so I'm not sure that that was quite clear to everybody. It sounds obvious, and now we know, but only because we documented it, we recorded it, and we adjusted over time. The time element is something that we don't play enough with, because people do different things throughout the day, throughout the week, throughout the month, or year. Another reason where we play the life cycle, how many times have you done a project where a customer comes in, I have this many users, these are my assumptions, and so forth, and we put in a service of that size? Turns out that, yep, in 5 years' time, the adoption was correct, but it took 5 years for the adoption to happen. SharePoint is a great example where people make a lot of these assumptions. So time is not just about the life cycle in behavior, it's also the adoption all up. So scale units and life cycle modeling kind of go hand in hand as a tool set to help you offset these uncertainties effectively.
So the other thing, when we look at the life cycle, typically we do it in the most common of terms, right? Looking over the course of the month, over the course of the week, and over the course of a day. But you could also have the life cycle of an event. So if you look at, I'm not sure if people looked at the news this morning, a lot of the news sites said that the Pope was going to resign. That's a popular news story. And you see news events that happen. Well, there's a life cycle of that, right? So it may not happen at 2 o'clock in the morning or 5 o'clock in the afternoon, but there is the event has happened. Starts going out on social media. Maybe there's an hour from event happening that we're now going to go viral and we're going to see this amount of users. We're going to go on and on and on for that. So if you can figure out that there's a new story that's coming in, I can now start ratcheting up capacity. Because as we've talked about with the discussion about roles, the roles don't come on like that, right? So based on my life cycle, I can start spinning these things up and getting them ready based on the historical models that we have. So at this point, you know, we've just talked about the life cycle. Now I understand what people need or what we think the life cycle of the app is. Now we need to figure out how available we want to make the app for that. So, and they may not be the same. Going back to the discussions earlier around cost, is, you know what, I could make it that available, but I can't afford it. I'm a startup. I'm going to handle a certain level of capacity. At that point, I'm going to show an error message. Maybe you're going to show a fail whale, if you're familiar with Twitter and how they handle capacity there. But really understanding availability there. But understanding for this workload, here's the level of availability that I'm going to make available for that, and here's the plan of how I'm going to go ahead and achieve that. And again, the nice thing about going by the workload level is if you get in a situation where you're now wildly popular, you can say, all right, well, there's certain things I can shut off, but I want to make sure that this particular workload, maybe it's the main website, maybe it's the about page, it's an enrollment form, so we're now hitting capacity. Hey, you know what? Put in your email address, we'll get back to you, and you'll be invited to our private beta, some sort of face-saving thing. You can make sure that those things are there and make sure you're shifting availability and your availability set for that particular workload in the application.
Additional videos in this series can be found on Channel 9 at http://channel9.msdn.com/series/failsafe. In addition, Microsoft Services and the Azure Customer Advisory Team have produced white papers and guidance on these subjects. You can find these on the Azure Architecture Center at http://www.windowsazure.com/en-us/develop/net/architecture.